credit resting, okay?
Yes, it's another edition of Graham Chapman Rests, a series of 400 half-hour programs which look at the life of a man who rests a lot. Playing Graham Chapman is Graham Chapman. Last week he rested. This week he starts off resting yet again.
Do you think I'm overdoing it? Or?
I think I saw your lip move.
Oh.
I think it's the zany gears a bit over the top. I think you just ought to wear something normal, Graham, like you usually wear, a carrot costume or a goose, something like that.
Oh, that's very good.
مازال احنا ما نسيناك يا حبيبي ولا فكرنا نجدك ومن كل اعماقنا بغيناك ومن كل اعماق.
What have the Romans ever done for us? They've led us by the bastards. They've taken everything we had, and not just from us. From our fathers, and from our fathers' fathers.
And from our fathers' fathers' fathers.
Yeah.
And from our fathers' 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 fathers.
Yeah, don't labour the point.
And what have they ever given us in return?
The aqueduct.
What?
The aqueduct.
Yeah, they gave us that. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and the sanitation.
Oh, yeah, the sanitation. Yeah. Remember what the city used to be like, Reg?
Yeah, all right. I grant you, the aqueduct and the sanitation are two things the Romans have done.
And the roads.
Well, yeah, obviously the roads go without saying, but apart from the sanitation, the aqueduct and the roads...
Irrigation.
Medicine.
Education.
Yeah, all right.
And the wine.
Yeah, that's one thing we really won't miss if the Romans weren't here.
Yeah, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, the education, the wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
Brought peace.
What? Peace? Oh, shut up!
Actually, I think we should do it.
The year is AD 33. Members of the People's Front of Judea plan their intended overthrow of the Roman Empire. They're led by Reg, better known as John Cleese. Indeed, the revolutionaries as a group are better known as Monty Python.
Thank you very much indeed.
I must scroll back.
She really loves your shows. We
come on, wax tablets. Oh, my daughter loves your programme. Yeah. She's only 18 months. It's just her sense of humour.
The Pythons are filming their life of Brian on location in Tunisia. It's a comedy.
One more rehearsal, sorry.
Right, OK, here
that's
we go.
Original script. Right. I won't say some of these jokes right. are old.
It's 10 years now since the six men formed their flying circus, and it's rare for them to work together nowadays. So we took this opportunity to take a look at the origins and the philosophy of the Monty Python phenomenon, and also eavesdrop, inconspicuously, on their current movie.
You can see yourselves at home now. See how silly you look?
Monty Python is a success story. 45 TV shows have been sold to more than 20 countries, from Zambia to Pakistan, from Japan to Germany.
Ich fälle Bäume, trag Stöckelschuh und Stumpf und Büstenhalter.
It's also constantly being rerun across America. The group has sold more than 1 million records and more than 1.25 million books. Their previous film, The Holy Grail, has grossed to date nearly $10 million.
Camelot! Camelot! Camelot!
It's only a model.
Accordingly, the Pythons are probably better known internationally than any other British group, and also richer.
Hello. I've been asked to read this prepared statement on behalf of the Monty Python boys, who are here on location in North Africa. Unfortunately, they have been so spoiled by success in show business that they are now too rich to speak, without being paid enormous sums of money. Also, for tax reasons, they're not really here, so stumm. However, they would very much have liked to talk to you, had you been able to afford them, especially as they're now making a film in Tunisia, which obviously they'd like to plug, as it's costing nearly $4.5 million, which is the sort of money these boys need now before they'll speak.
Despite their success and wealth as a troupe, the Pythons have split up and gone their separate ways. So this is something of a reunion.
And as a special favour, in memory of this, they have consented to wave at the camera.
Eric Idle devised his own BBC Two series, Rutland Weekend Television.
I think it's John's title, Rutland Weekend Television. I once bought it off him for a shilling for life, the world rights forever. And I don't know, it appealed to me. I like the small. I mean, I've got a parody mind, really. And it's just the small compared to the large is always funny.
On Rutland Weekend's new dramatization of one of the world's longest books. Malicious Glimpf has taken Leo Tolstoy's very long story, War and Peace, and turned it into a very long television series.
I think I learned more from that than I did from Python, as a matter of fact, because it's only when you can really expand and make a lot of mistakes that you can learn anything. So I find that's a very useful thing about of doing something small for BBC Two in a cupboard, you know, for no money. What you learn is never do anything small for BBC Two in a cupboard for no money.
Idle had great success on NBC in America, both as a presenter of Saturday Night Live and with his own special, The Ruttles. I must
be in love. Well, George was in it. George was always a Ruttle fan. Apparently John liked it. Ringo, I think, liked it after 68, he said.
He did. Job.
I'm leaving you.
Well, when are you coming back?
I'm not. I'm going for good.
What for?
We're just not getting on.
Not getting on? We happen to be very happily married.
We're not.
I am.
I'm not.
Oh, I see. So it's not a question of we're not happily married. It's you. Why not?
We always seem to be arguing.
Rubbish.
We're arguing now.
No, we're not. We're discussing.
We're arguing.
I won't let you get me into an argument by insisting that we're arguing.
Everything that you're right, of course, naturally comes from experience. And a lot of experiences that you'd rather not go through again. And if you can enlarge on those things and make them seem even more ridiculous than they were when they happened to you, then maybe they might stop.
Chapman plays the lead in this film, but he also makes his living as a writer. He scripted many of the Doctor series for ITV, not surprisingly, as that's what he used to be. In fact, his parents would have preferred him to remain a student at St Bartholomew's Hospital rather than going to New Zealand with the Cambridge Footlights Review.
But fortunately, at the time, I was secretary of the Students' Union, and the Queen Mother was opening a new biochemistry block at St Bartholomew's, and so, as secretary of the Students' Union, I got to have tea with the Queen Mother. She has beautiful skin. She does. Very nice. And very pleasant lady. When I mentioned the fact that I'd been offered this part in a tour of New Zealand, she said, "Oh, you must go. Such a beautiful place and interesting." So I used that on my parents as though it was a royal command, and it worked.
Terry Jones is the director of the current film.
Can we oil Mike a bit?
So healthy. I'm never conscious of actually doing anything positive. It's only sort of trying to get the camera rolling at the right time, I suppose.
Okay.
Everybody's relying on sort of they're doing things, performing things, and then saying, "Was that all right, really?" And it's a question of sort of everybody saying, "Well, yes, we think that was all right, or perhaps you could do this a little bit differently."
Start again.
Jones is something of an intellectual. He's just finished a book about the night and the Canterbury Tales.
It's a rather sort of a intimate study of 30 lines of the Canterbury Tales. It's really basically it's explaining some 600-year-old jokes. It's just sort of trying to find out what was making them laugh 600 years ago and why these lines were funny and why Chaucer wrote them.
Although he's directing this picture on his own, he directed Monty Python and the Holy Grail with Terry Gilliam.
Now stand aside, worthy adversary.
'Tis but a scratch.
A scratch? Your arm's off.
No, it isn't.
Well, what's that, then?
I've heard worse.
my feeling on the last one was that with two of us directing, we're always shouting. Both of us run on adrenaline, really, and we're both shouting madly. And the crew, I found it very confusing for the crew. I think the crew found it that way, too. And I thought it wasn't really the best thing. I think fascism, whatever it is, dictatorship is really important in filmmaking in a way. It really needs one voice, really, to hold it together.
Where's he going?
Terry Gilliam, the American who did the animations for the TV series, is designing this film.
I don't see the point in making sort of jokey backgrounds for the thing because the actions and the comedies and the words and what people are doing. I really quite like the idea of trying to make some sort of real world or apparently real world. It may not be the real world as you or other people know it, but the Romans sort of came in and sort of started knocking through rooms and then putting their columns in and trying to impose their architecture on it. And they failed rather miserably. So it's a very odd set.
Gilliam directed another Python, Michael Palin, in his independent film, Jabberwocky.
Terry Gilliam lives very near to me and comes and offers me parts in films occasionally, because I live nearby. If you live near Terry Gilliam, you'd be all right. He'll come by in his big car and offer you a part in a film.
Like Eric Idle, Michael Palin was offered a BBC Two series of his own. He wrote it with Terry Jones. They've been writing together since they left Oxford.
She will be baited. Unfortunately, you won't see it until the BBC documentary comes out.
Yes.
So I think being given the offer to do a show, and I didn't want to do any sort of Michael Palin show, Michael Palin introduces sort of thing. And Terry and I were sort of sitting around thinking what to write. And I think actually it was, I'd given Terry a book for Christmas called Ripping Tales or something like that. And we couldn't actually think of what area to go into for a half hour. I think Terry's brother suggested, well, you know, something like that, Ripping Tales, Boy's Own Paper. So I think we started off writing then the school story, and it seemed to work. And that was only, we only just did the one off at the time.
It was the same with me dad. He pretended to be French when he came in, hoping I wouldn't talk to him.
Oh, quel journée, basta latter. Je suis très fatigué demain, Vera.
Oh, yes, dear. Eh bien, le repas est prêt.
What?
Your supper's ready.
And our Irene, my sister, she was just downright rude.
Irene? Guess who's got a new shovel, then?
Oh, shut up, you boring little tit.
Irene, taisez-vous.
That's enough, dear. Well, he's such a short-ass little creep, he's driving me out of my tree.
Oh, yes, the most, world's most boring man. Yes, based on anybody, Eric Althwaite. Based on myself, I think. I love rainfall and all that in the north. I wanted to do a character spoken in a northern voice all the time. And they do, don't they? There is a character like that who's always around talking like that all the time. I like the fact that in the end he came out as you know, sort of idolised by the entire town, which was a nice little twist on it. It was just nice to do a few Yorkshire accents and go up there and film in my home county and all that. Actually, we didn't. We filmed in Durham, because Yorkshire wasn't grotty enough. Oh, no, no. Sorry, Durham. Oh, God.
The sixth member of the Monty Python team is John Cleese. He also had his own series on BBC, Forty Towers, which he wrote with Connie Booth.
Connie and I have always had a thing about suppressed rage, people who can't express their rage properly, which neither of us can. We always find it very funny to see people getting really steamed up, not being able to blast. Although Basil usually does blast, but that's really once at the end of the show when he's been provoked beyond any reasonable expectation of controlling his feelings any longer. That was a part of it. And the other part was, I suppose, that there was certainly a certain amount of me in him and certainly a certain amount of my father. And I suppose with the suppressed anger, a certain amount of Connie too, as I've said. So it was a private thing. I never expected it to catch on anywhere, anything like the way it did.
What?
Do Jimmy Cagney instead.
What?
Jimmy Cagney.
Jimmy Cagney?
No, yo, dirty rat.
I can't do Jimmy Cagney.
Please try. I'm gonna get you.
Shut up. Here, watch. Who's this then? Strike you, but. I'll do the funny walk.
And all the scripts that I'm sent now consist of people who run into rooms and are rude to everyone and then usually hit somebody and then probably smash a few things, you know. Sort of like late Marty sketches, you know. And this is apparently all I can do now. But Basil was a sort of private thing. It came out of this hotel that we'd stayed at in Torquay, and this wonderful gentleman, who's now, I'm glad to say, emigrated to Canada, there'd been no libel proceedings. It was based on him and his wonderful bad temper, which just made me laugh.
I think everybody's hoping the other's going to fail dismally.
There are strengths which you get from the group of six, which you can never get from doing something on your own or in a partnership.
Good. I think it's actually it's a salvation in a way, because one can become such an unbearable egomaniac if left to one's own devices.
It's such a tight, anal little group. It won't let anything alone, you know. It's just won't wing or busk anything. It's just get it right, get it right. And there's always one mind that's worrying and niggling at it and won't let it go. That's the healthy thing of it. They're not bad company. A bit noisy. In the early mornings. Oh! Let that secret out.
There's no hidden fighting, I don't think, anymore.
There's a much nicer, I suppose you could say almost healthier feeling in the group, because towards the end of the time when we'd been working together, which I suppose was about 4 to 5 years, working 10 months in the year together, probably, I think that certainly I, and to a lesser extent Michael and Eric, were very, very keen to run off and chase our own tails. That's Michael now hiding behind the branch. If he moves it, he's going to plant it. He's got a book on gardening. This is another of his exhibits. Good morning, Michael.
I was just practicing for the burning fiery bush scene.
Oh, right.
Carry on.
He's written a fiery bush.
Good luck with the makeup sketch.
What Michael has. It's a strong grip.
Oh, John, hurry up and get made up. That's 4 makeups every morning. That's impossible, you know.
They don't always interview me. I have to sit here being made up until they come along. You know, they only ever interview people when they're being made up.
Well, I'll see you in the caravan. I can't wait any longer, John.
All right, Hen.
You promised me 9:30 in the caravan. I've got the baby oil.
Right. I'll be in there.
Okay.
Inflate it, won't you?
As well as their fame and their money, the group has a more lasting achievement. They contributed a new word to the English language. Pythonesque.
A camel is a
everybody
a bus stuffed by very bad taxidermists. A bus stuffed by blind taxidermists. How about that?
Like that? Mm.
Mm.
A
double decker. That's a dromedary.
Camel is a lolly seen through an enormous magnifying glass.
I was going to say, a camel is an ice cream that I wouldn't eat.
Wasn't it great this morning when that camel got a big stiffy and ran around the field?
Oh, a big, really long one.
It was the longest thing I've ever bloody seen, that.
That wasn't a camel, that was a donkey.
Donkey.
Designed by a camel.
Donkey is a camel without any hump.
You can see what ran around behind my camel.
A donkey is a camel no one designed.
Before they hatched the apocryphal python, all 6 of them had made reputations in other television comedy programmes.
Mike Terry and I and Terry Gilliam were all working on a show for Thames, and they didn't have a studio for 2 years, so we'd already got a show to go to there. And then John and Graham were going to do a show, and I think basically John wanted to get more people. I would say that it was John's desire to be in more of a larger group rather than do a John Cleese, Graham Chapman show. That sort of made him naturally evolve towards, I think Michael appealed to him, and we were kind of with Michael.
Mike was a bit dubious to start with, actually, because they nearly had a series themselves lined up. I think it was at Thames. So it was a little sort of, well, not quite sure, and we left it open for a week or two, and then we thought, well, why not? And we went along to Barry Took, I think.
Barry Took, who actually sort of acted as the sort of middleman between us and the BBC. And I remember all cramming into a little office with Michael Mills, and he just came in and said, and Ian McNaughton and John Howard Davis and Barry, he said, what do you want? And we said, well, we want to Well, just sort of do a show or something. OK, fine, 13 shows. We'll see how we go from there. Left the room.
It's...
The first two episodes, I went along to the first rehearsal and I thought, what the hell is all this about? I didn't know at all. I sat there with my mouth open, totally agog, the first few rehearsals. I just didn't know what it was all about. And then gradually I thought, well, whatever it is, it's silly and it's fun and...
I think we had no idea what it was going to be like, and I think even during the first recording, we had no idea what it was going to be like. No idea at all. It was only like... We were about four ahead before it started to go out. And I know we had gangs of BBC audiences brought in coachloads, you know, these sort of elderly women who sat and tried to look for Derek Nimmo, you know.
Fortunately, as it went out so late at night, very few people had seen it, and it gradually began to get a cult status, which means, you know, it was seen by insomniacs and intellectuals and burglars.
I think early on, BBC had this was 10 years ago, this was Hugh Green was still in charge. I think BBC was a very different organisation then. There was much more independence, and I think to the producer, I mean, each producer was much more, he wasn't looking over his shoulder all the time to see what the person above thought. And I think then people were allowed to just get on and make the programmes, and then they were criticised afterwards, maybe. There was a sort of a body of opinion. I mean, you had Tom Sloan, who was then head of Light Entertainment, after about the fourth show, said to Ian McNaughton, the producer, well, this is terrible, this show isn't funny at all. You've got to do something about it.
I mean, I think the people who liked Python right at the start, the sort of first wave audience, knew exactly what we were on about. And then I think there was another wave that joined in later that really thought it was all about dressing up, doing silly things, you know.
One man more than any other who cleared the ground for this sort of humour, surrealist to some, just silly to others, was Spike Milligan.
And said yes.
Thank you, and that's the end of the news.
The Goon Show, broadcast in the early 50s, had been just as much a cult as Python was later to become.
It started off, didn't it? It was the first breakout after the war.
Yeah.
Everybody there was a great anti-feeling of everything, you know.
That's right.
And the most important thing was to get as much past the BBC censors as we could. And we used to stick... like the soldiers laugh. You see the sailors laugh at certain jokes and the soldiers laugh at certain jokes. Yeah. Then came the civilians. That's when it got tough.
We have to embarrass Spike by pointing out how old he is. Because we were all Python fans when we were 15 or 16.
Or Goon fans, you mean?
I'm sorry, Goon fans. Well, things are interchangeable, yeah. You did 1984, Spike.
Yes, we
did. And you got a good review in Punch. And I ran into my father bearing the review, you know, and saying, you see, it is good. Because, of course, he couldn't stand it.
Really?
Said it was a lot of rubbish. All the things that get said about us.
And my father liked it.
Did he? Yes.
My mother didn't. She hated it. And my mother with Python, she only likes the bits that I'm in.
And for me, the turning point came very early on when I saw the first of Spike Milligan's. I think it was Q4 then. And suddenly flash went through my mind, really. I suddenly remembered one of Terry Gilliam's cartoons he'd done, which was called Elephants. And he did it for Do Not Adjust Your Set. And he said he was a bit worried about it because it was just chain of consciousness. And he didn't know how it was going to work. And in fact, it was fantastic. It just went, this one thing went to another, went to another.
I was sitting there doing the title sequences, and they were in this tune, the Liberty Bell, and I just thought you had to end it with something swift and violent and final. And what better than this godlike foot descending? The wonderful thing is, the foot is actually the foot from a painting by Bronzino. It's a foot of Cupid. And now it's become this incredibly destructive thing that smashes down. I think people liked it, maybe probably for the same reason I do. It's like this terrible fantasy of when problems are getting so impossible, there's no way to deal with it. It would be so lovely if something like that was around that just went squash and everything finalized, finished, easy.
People could write fragments of a sketch, three or four lines which seemed to work, and they could be used, they could be thrown in somewhere instead of saying, well, I'm afraid you can't develop that, you know, because you've not got the basic ingredients as laid down in the law of comedy, you know, beginning, middle, and a tag.
We'll get the new poo-poo machine. Embarrass your guests. Completely authentic sound. Or why not try a new naughty nighty? Put it on and it melts. Just wash their faces. Guaranteed to break the ice at naughty parties. Go on. Do the punchline. What punchline? The punchline for this bit. I don't know it. Didn't say anything about a punchline. Oh! Well, in that case, I'll be saying goodbye then, sir. Goodbye then, sir.
And the thing that impressed me slightly is a few years later, I went back to do another comedy show at the BBC, a sort of guest appearance, and we got to the end of the sketch and the camera was going in and the band was going da-da-da-da, you know, as if Python had not pointed out that there are quicker and sharper ways of getting on with it, you know?
Yes, you know, it's a man's life in England's mountains green.
Right, I heard that. I'm going to stop this sketch now. And if there's any more of this, I'm going to stop the whole programme. I thought it was supposed to be about teeth anyway. Why can't you do something about teeth? Go on.
My rustic monologue. I'm not sleeping with that producer again.
Suddenly you began to look at all these other... The careers that people are trying to force you into and see the absurdities very much more clearly. I think that's sort of the greatest source of a lot of Python humour is that we're all come from middle-class backgrounds in which the professions loom very large. And as everybody who writes, you write material which is largely autobiographical from your own experience. And so I think in Python's case, we were able to write about these people because we met a lot of them, or our fathers knew them, or our fathers met them, or our fathers had great respect for them, or whatever.
Rightfully unsuccessful to say, right, today we will write a sketch which clearly exposes the folly of human existence, or something like that, because then you finish up with a very boring bit of material. But if you sit down and write something in a chemist's shop, and after it's about 2 minutes, something... Just, you know, I'm afraid I am. Could you keep it down a little?
Fine, okay. I don't like to get into other people's interviews. It won't cut well, you know.
Terry Gilliam. The art man. But he's doing the art direction on the movie. Mainly because he's not very good at words. Being American, he has a very small vocabulary, which is largely consists of the two phrases. One is,
yeah, I really like that. And the other is, you're really pissing me off.
And life is divided for Terry into these two clear and distinct categories, things that he really likes and things that pisses him off.
Three layers of matchboxes to clear, and silence over! And it's over beautifully! Oh, the jump of a lifetime, if only his father could understand!
Yes, there was a little place called the Loose Box in Kensington, where there were lots of people that had practically no chin and would wahoo late into the night and slam car doors and it was all, hello Jane, how's Seymour? And all that sort of thing, you know. Ugh. Terrible people. And so we had a competition devised for them, the upper class Twitter, yeah. I don't know whether it had any effect on them, but apparently it went down very well at the Palace.
Yeah, they are! They're coming up to the Debs! Gervais first, Vivian second, Simon third, and now they've got to take the bras off from the front! This is really difficult, this! This is really the most difficult part of the entire competition! Oh my God, they're having a bit of trouble in there, I think!
I mean, the English are funny because they're crazy. They're mad as hatters. If you go around the world, you discover the English are quite mad and just are very funny, and they don't really realise it.
As philosophers, we're... pretty nth rate. I mean, we're not not very high-powered as philosophers or social critics, so our only claim to people's attention is that we can sometimes make them laugh. But within that context, I hope, you know, we have attitudes, I suppose.
I have moments of sheer sort of unconstructive silliness, like the fish slapping dance I liked a lot, which was John and I on the side of the canal at Teddington. And we were both in sort of pith helmets and very long sort of khaki shorts. And did this little dance with two very small fish, which was sort of doom-de-doom-de-doom, boom, and slapped John's face very lightly. Doom-de-doom-de-doom, boom, doom-de-doom-de-doom, boom, 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 dee. Which John produced this huge fish about sort of 6 feet long from behind him, just hit me on the side of the head and I fell 15 feet into the canal. End of sketch. Very silly, you know, to get a whole unit together to do that. But that was, you know, there was no reason for that at all. I'm very glad to have done it. It's just a little memory.
The Bristol Education Authority will write to me one day and say, you realise we paid you £600 between the years 1960 and 63, and we've decided we want it back.
Terence Baylor.
Yes! Oh, super!
Eric Idle.
Yes!
He can come!
Terry Gwillam.
Oh, he's here too!
No, Gillingham.
Gillingham.
Sorry.
Graham Chapman. Oh. And Charles McEwan.
Oh, present. All here.
Got them all in. Right. Perfect.
Now, we're all gathered here. This is the pre-take chat banter that goes on amongst the actors before the take. Roy just walking through there. There's a lot of nerves at this point. Some of the chaps are actually damp in the knickers, but the others here are just gathered to talk about their old performances.
Their new film is set in Judea in the first century, but the satire is aimed more at the factions and sub-factions in the Middle East today.
Now, I have to have a moment's quiet now just to think about this performance.
You know, we seem to be involved in making history. I mean, what we tend to do is put a sort of modern consciousness on it. You get sort of suburban attitudes in AD 33. It's about how they're complaining and grumpy and unpleasant.
Cut. Cut. It's fine. Enough. Cut.
Lighting the flames. Flames lit.
In the basement of Pilate's palace, the campaign for Free Galilee and the People's Front of Judea unfortunately find themselves on the same mission.
All right, you've got your demands, won't you?
Of course we have.
What are they?
Well, I'm not telling you that. Yeah. Oh, that's the other one. Anyway, we thought of it before you.
Did not.
We did.
You didn't.
Planning this for months, you bastards.
You bloody didn't. Tough titty for you. Oh!
Well, the thing that we've all observed about the behaviour of revolutionary groups is that if they're on the left, they tend to hate each other more than they actually hate people who were originally intended to be the enemy. So I've got a wonderful tract, a Stalinist tract, attacking the Trotskyites, which is really absolutely wonderful. The virulence, they couldn't have topped it if they were going after the National Front.
Any questions?
What exactly are the demands?
We're giving Pilate 2 days to dismantle the entire apparatus of the Roman imperialist state, and if he doesn't agree immediately, we execute it.
Cut the head off! Cut all our bits off. Send them back every hour on the hour to show that we're not to be trifled with.
Also, we're demanding a 10-foot mahogany statue of the Emperor Julius Caesar with his dock hanging out.
What? I'll never agree to that, Reg.
It's just a bargaining counter. Also, we're pointing out to them that they bear full responsibility when we chop her up and that we shall not submit to blackmail.
The music that so many of them make, you know, it's a way of talking, which in fact seems to be completely unrelated to reality. People talk that way because they've seen other people talk that way. That is the way to address a crowd, or that is the way to address a meeting. So that's what I learned to do, and then the next generation learn it from me. It's like Shakespearean acting, you know.
Well, why don't you go and tell him that you want to be a leper again?
There's no direct parody of Jesus in the film, but there is a former leper who's annoyed because the begging business has dropped off since he's been cured.
Keep going, start again.
Well, why don't you go and tell him that you want to be a leper again?
Yeah, I could do that, sir, yeah. What I was thinking of doing, though, I was going to ask him if he'd make me a bit lame in one leg during the middle of the week. You know, something beggable, but not leprosy, which is a pain in the arse. Excuse my French, to be blunt, sir, but...
Brian! Can you clean your room out?
I don't know about the miracles. I mean, a lot of the healing, the faith healing, I would imagine was absolutely sensible. I mean, anyone who is suffering from symptoms of something that's basically got a hysterical foundation, then that could easily happen. I would have thought that would just as much as faith healing is a fact of life. Yeah. That all makes sense to me. Water into wine, I would have been very dubious about. Frankly, Brian. Over the moon if it happened, but...
Although Terry Jones and Terry Gilliam, as director and designer, are working nearly all the time, with the script completed, the other Pythons have plenty of time to relax.
I soon stopped that. He didn't have an appointment, he just came up and started rubbing. I had a slight back strain after I'd been doing some heavy drinking. I've been okay so far. It's just everyone seems to have had a sort of bad dose of...
Yes, it's a very interesting book. I'm reading The Life Cloud, The Origin of Life in the Universe, with Fred Wall and M.C. Wickramasinghe.
With an introduction by Brian Johnston.
Brian Johnson's life story. In this chapter, Brian and Peter West go to the West Indies. It's a very interesting story.
Eric has largely been reading the Brian Johnston story. What's it called?
It's called...
I forget what it's called. Up My Way, I think. Or...
It's acclaimed generally as the funniest book that's been around for months, yeah?
Yes, but it's very, very, very slow, like Brian. It sort of tends to go on and on a bit.
You can't read more than a couple of pages at a time.
without having a 20-minute break.
I was saying that I had my hair transplant done, and I'm very proud of it. I don't know if you can see it. The hair is quite good, you see, but it's in slight... That comes later. It's in slight clumps, but as it gets longer, it really begins to look quite good. Don't you think?
That's personal vanity, wherever
you are. I would like to admit that, but for tax reasons, I have to explain it was really purely for professional reasons. There was an element of vanity, like about 140%.
You mean your hair is tax deductible?
Well, I got half off my teeth. That's not a bad lot, is it? Oh, look at that.
God.
That's pure porcelain, that is.
How many have borrowed, John?
There's only one of mine in there, and I've forgotten which one it is.
Your teeth left on the national debt.
Well, the knee, the right knee, that was deductible, as you can see. It's remarkable, isn't it?
My teeth don't fit. Well, that's my personal grumble, but I'm not really talk to the boys about it. Well, they broke, you see, the teeth. I have four teeth here, which I carry around with me and only put in every now and then to eat. And they broke earlier on and were sent back to London in a special delivery, diplomatic bag. Came back repaired, but I think they'd put an extra tooth in there or slightly widened them. So when I put them in the other day, they just wouldn't quite fit. The one tooth there didn't quite fit, so I tried working with them in yesterday.
Right, Matthew.
Sounded a bit like that, I suppose. So I thought this may affect the performance, give it a certain amount of character that it lacks. But this morning I said to hell with it, and I left them in the little.
Sorry, we're doing an interview.
Sorry, we're doing an interview for the BBC.
Tell them about my teeth. I've nearly finished. So I left them in the little glass in the hotel today, which probably shocked the maid when she comes around.
Are they
tax deductible? Well, they're totally deductible. Don't pay any tax on this lot. That's open space, mate. That's building land in there. That's good development land, that is.
Yeah. I'm missing out on this orthodontal tax evasion.
It's very nice. I spend a lot of time in dentists. I should think I go. I spend about two or three days each week in a dentist of one kind or another. Never thought of it before. But
it's quite rare for the pythons to spend time together nowadays. And although they seem to enjoy each other's company, constant togetherness is not something they all particularly relish.
Oh, gross!
It's an efficient working unit. It's not really a sort of a good party unit. It has a very bad time socially. I mean, there's nothing worse than dinner with everybody around the table.
Why is that?
Well, it's a bit like a boarding school, you know? It's kind of... You know, it's too efficient as a work unit.
If you can distance yourself from them at all.
Shut up, John. Never been the same since Fawlty Towers.
Just as much as their view of the world, the pythons' view of each other is the bedrock of their humour. They're intrigued by each other, even amused by each other.
Eric? He's always got something going for him, some crusade, which makes him feel a little more laid back than anyone else. Laid back is the way he currently feels. Because I don't know what it means, but he's definitely laid back. He told me he was.
Eric Idle, yes, Eric does a lot of jokes. You have to slow Eric down on the jokes just a little bit. It's all right the first 3 hours, you know, but...
Terry Jones is a fanatic about filming in particular. And I've noticed that he's at home a fanatic about real things like real ale and unprocessed food, which means that here, of course, he's constantly eating fish, which comes out of one of the most unnatural oceans in the world, which is full of men's effluent. And while he's being folklorique, he's getting a gastrointestinal flora, which is folklorique, to such an extent that I have to fill him up with little pink pills so that he can direct.
And Terry Jones, who, of course, is Welsh, so it's very difficult to know what else to say, but don't get into an argument with Terry unless you sort of have a free week, basically.
Terry is an American, yes. He can make strange sounds. But he hasn't quite learned to talk yet. I remember him once... He has a relatively small vocabulary, I suppose. He says bunch a lot, when he means a lot, a lot. I remember him when we were flying over We're doing a tour of Canada, and we're flying over the Great Lakes, and Terry looked out of the window and said, "Hey, you guys, a whole bunch of water." Which really sums Terry up, I think.
I mean, he's just as bright and as verbal as anyone. It's just that at moments it seems to leave him. I think at moments of creative excitement, I think that's when it tends to go. His legs are wonderful. Have you seen his legs?
Michael Payne was appallingly normal. He would agree with me there, I think. Yes, there he is, with wife and children, all very happy together, in not too large a house, not too small a house, in a not too nice part of London, that's not too awful either, with moderately terrible neighbours that are quite pleasant, really, when you get to know them.
Michael is, I think, probably the funniest, really, in conversation. He's delightfully silly, and he's liable to run into absolutely inspired spells of complete, it's creative genius, actually. I mean, he just goes in certain characters, and he just creates material. Really, the only person I know who can do that, apart from Peter Cook, he's a terribly nice man, Mike. I always told him he was much too nice for his own good.
Oh, Cleesey. Yes. A strange fellow, Cleesey. I've never actually seen the top of him, always in cloud.
I like John a lot. I think he's incredibly strange.
He's a very tender person. He's very shy and sort of really soft inside. He puts on this huge exterior and bluff. He gets very cross, you know, he gets very worked up. And the great thing about his comedy is he works it absolutely all out. It's all up front, straight out and used. It's very healthy. But he's really a cutie.
I don't know how to describe John. I think he would probably take sex too seriously, for instance. There'd have to be some other point other than pleasure in it, perhaps. It has to be a little cerebral. If he read, perhaps, some authority has said that it is extremely good, then it will be.
But Graham Chapman is probably more candid about himself than he is teasing about the others. For several years, he was almost an alcoholic.
Perhaps it's having come from a grammar school gov and going up with all those people in Cambridge and all that. I think I felt inferior. That's the reason. I suppose drink gave me courage to speak up and use my voice.
Graham is wonderful in his missing years. And in fact, one misses him somewhat on some occasions, which is stuffy and formal. One really needs Graham crawling around the room, trying to kiss all the men and insult all the women. I mean, it did have a certain dangerous "you are here now" feel to it. I mean, you know the story, and the answer really is that he's been an absolute transformation, because there was a time when there was this strange, preoccupied creature wandering around, forever looking at his watch and missing the point of what was being said. And now he's transformed into a sort of benevolent, intelligent man who is completely with it and who knows what's going on.
For a time, he was outspoken about his homosexuality.
I suppose I'm outspoken about it probably over much, in fact, because I was crusading a little bit. I think the atmosphere's a lot healthier now. I've even had doubts myself, you know, on occasions, that I might perhaps be going the other way.
We go along different paths, really. It's like sort of knowing somebody who's on a railway line next to you. And you're not in the same carriage, you're in the same train, but you're going along together, waving happily at each other, and sort of, I think, respecting each other's differences, perhaps.
Oh, look! He has given us a sign!
He has given us a show!
A shoe is the sign! Let us follow his example!
What do you mean?
Let us, like him, carry one shoe, and let the other be upon our foot, for this is his sign, that all who follow him shall do likewise!
No, 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 no! The shoe is a sign that we must gather!
Hold up, good!
No, 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 it's a sign that, like him, we must think not of the things of the body, but of the face and head!
Give me your shoe!
No, get up!
Stand off!
No, it's not!
Cast it away!
Keep it on!
Clear off!
Follow the shoe!
shoes. They will leave us to him.
All you who call yourself Goody!
I think it's worth doing Python as long as we feel there are things to say, I suppose, and feel there are things wrong as we look around the world. The world changes as well. It's never going to get the way we see it. So I'm sure there is always something to flail out against as we sink into the oblivion.
Yeah, but if I see something which there's bad language used and I enjoy it, I actually usually ring up the BBC. I don't give my name because they obviously think I've got an axe to grind. Yeah. Just as a viewer, if something's made me laugh, I think it's very nice that that bloke was able to say, you silly sod, instead of you silly chump.
Do you actually say that to them?
I'm very glad I enjoyed the programme and I thought it was very real and I thought the bad language was absolutely justified. Because I don't, you know, I mean, we all...
This is a much cheaper film.
Much more film. But we have a little film over there to do. Don't mind.
Now, which one is this?
This is when you're a crowd again.
I'm getting confused between the cameras.
What is that one
shooting you?
That's Granada shooting a BBC film about us.
Come along. Well, who's shooting Granada?
Well, that's
Tunis. Oh, that's Tunis.
Right, now all these people are going to come rushing through here, so you'll have to move.
After a day's filming like this, we'll probably go back and have a sort of drug-based orgy of some kind or another. Women will be brought in, politicians, anybody, you know, as good as an orgy. And a lot of stuff will be smoked, drunk, talked, you know. There'll be three kinds of orangeade. There'll be Ribena. There'll be cherryade for the children, there are children. And, of course, obviously straw for the animals.
That extract featured Graham Chapman as Brian and Terry Jones, who also directed the picture, as Mandy, mother of Brian. With us tonight, another one-third of Monty Python, John Cleese and Michael Palin.
Cracked. BBC cutbacks.
Michael, why the name Brian?
Well, I don't know. We've always used Brian in Python to portray a certain sort of character, fairly anonymous, and I apologise to anyone called Brian, slightly sort of...
I mean, there's a good chance of...
dim. No, not dim. That's not fair. It's slow to catch on.
And there's a fighting chance of at least one Brian watching tonight, so be careful.
I don't know. Have you seen the figures? Cheap, wasn't it? Cheap. No, actually, John was in a sketch about a footballer being interviewed in one of the very early Python shows, and it was all, Brian. Yeah, the ball in the back of the net, Brian.
I'm opening a boutique, Brian. But it's one of the funny names, isn't it? It's like Trevor and Kevin. I mean, they're just funny.
What inspired the film, Life of Brian? I mean, how did that strange idea take root in... And indeed, in whose skull did it take root?
Well, we're not exactly certain. It's always difficult to find the exact moment when it came up. But I know that when we were going around the world sort of doing premieres for the Holy Grail. And we had a lot of time to spare in airports and cafes and restaurants. We got to thinking about a new film and what particular area we might go in. And we were still keen to do a historical film. I said, you know, more fun dressing up and all that. We'd done the Bowler Hatted City Gents on Python. And I think it was Eric who came up with this title out of the blue called Jesus Christ Lust for Glory. And I must admit that when we started talking about it, we actually explored the idea of doing a comedy film about Jesus, you know, with all the jokes about someone trying to book a table for 12 at the Last Supper. Sorry, sir, you know, Saturday night, I'll do you 3-4s. Come in tomorrow. No, it's got to be tonight, and all those jokes. And the more that we read about Jesus and the background to his life, it was quite obvious that there was very little to ridicule in Jesus' life, and therefore we were sort of onto a loser. The characters we like to portray in Python are failures, are dim, are idiotic, are sort of incapable in one way or another. Jesus was a straight, direct man, so making very good sense. And so we decided that we'd be very, sort of just a rather shallow film, just about Jesus. So we got Brian in.
You must have known, though, that even in those early days, you were heading for trouble and criticism and controversy. A, because you were well known. B, because, you know, to put it mildly, the subject matter is quite well known.
Yeah,
I don't know. Did that worry you?
I mean, I feel that Python, that's, we've always thrived on that. It's always been a bit of an uphill struggle.
So what came first? Was it the laughter idea or the message? I mean, which was the first of the two that...
It's the laughter. We go for the jokes first. I mean, the reason that it sounded like an interesting territory to go into, to explore, because when you go in there, you really don't know what you're going to write. I mean, we usually sit around for about 3 days discussing theoretically what we're going to write, and then we go around and write something completely different. And the film actually starts when somebody comes in halfway through the second week and reads something out, and we all laugh. And that's the first point on the graph. Yeah. Do you see what I mean?
Yes,
and then we
may
wait another week, and then somebody else writes something funny, and then we have 2 points on the graph. And when we've got about 6 or 7, we start writing stuff to join it together. It's a pretty slow process because it's sort of democracy gone mad.
It took a long time for Brian to really get off the ground. We wrote an awful lot, which was then just thrown away because it was sort of struggling too hard to be sort of controversial.
I don't know. I agree with that because I don't think that we were coming in with stuff about Christ. Mm. We all started writing about around the edges, all the people who'd arrived 5 minutes after the miracle had been done. which is as bad as being 2,000 years late. The point is, if you didn't see it, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're 5 minutes late or whatever. Actually, we did have the idea that he was the 13th disciple, didn't we? A sort of slight hanger-on.
Yes. Yes.
Yes, that's right. he was going to write a gospel, but he was always late.
Because it was also called Brian of Nazareth at one point, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And yet you changed that title, yet that would have worked, wouldn't it, for this movie or not?
Well, I think, I always thought that title somehow asked for the comparison with Jesus of Nazareth, you know, the Powell thing, too much. It looked as though we were going for the comparison.
But you apparently used Lou Grade's sets that he used on Jesus of Nazareth. Didn't you, in fact, use the same scenario?
The ones he hadn't taken down. We used them for building our own sets in. There was temples there in Monastir, in this place in Tunisia.
Which it was luck, really, because we at one stage we were looking for about, I think there were 5 or 6 different places we might have shot it. Italy, Spain, Jordan, Israel, Morocco, Tunisia. And I think we decided Tunisia eventually, partly because we thought there might be religious trouble in the Catholic countries, and partly because we discovered they'd be making a lot of films in the last 2 or 3 years in Tunisia. And then when you sort of say, we'll get the rushes here in the morning, you don't arrive and find there's a lot of rushes there. You know,
there's practically an industry over there of making films about Jesus, because Rossellini had made a film, then Lou Grade had been there for a couple... Rossellini, an Italian director, made a film about Jesus, then... Well, I don't worry.
I missed that.
He thought it was a footballer, didn't he?
I thought it was a food.
FC Turin. No, Rossellini made this film, and then I thought it was rather good.
Is he good, Rossellini?
Yeah, he's a bit slow. He worked the second half, he was very good. Hit the ball, and there it was in the back of the stand.
If he's watching, I'm terribly sorry, but I've never heard of the guy.
Well,
he's made a film. Has it come out?
He's made a film about Jesus. And it came out, yes, I think so.
Well, the extraordinary thing is, Tim, I don't know all the facts on this because I was only told this about 4 days ago, but apparently there are now 4, quote, funny, unquote, films about the Bible coming out the next 3 months.
As a result of Brian, or just coincidentally?
Well, I don't know. I think it may just be coincidence. Mm. Mind you, we've been talking about it on and off for 3 years, so maybe the idea sort of filtered into somebody else's
consciousness. How did the whole thing get together? Because you had this great idea in an airport lounge or wherever, and still you have a fairly long way to go from, you know, Terminal 2 to screens.
It was
all
a
over
very
the world.
Big airport. It was ages.
Well, it is that pragmatic thing.
Because you had trouble with the cash and backers pulling out.
Oh, terrible trouble, yes. In fact, if George Harrison hadn't known Eric Idle, the film wouldn't have been made. Mm. Because although the Americans, I mean, after the EMI thing fell through, We then went to America.
No,
what happened? I didn't say anything. Failed to happen, as it were. We then went to America, and they were all prepared to give us a little bit of money, but not enough, not as much as we needed to make the film. So we needed, I think, $2.5 million to make it for the American territories, and they wouldn't give us more than 1¾. So come the middle of the year, we suddenly realised we weren't going to make it. And then out of the blue, John Goldstone, the producer, said, well, I've got one more meeting with George Harrison. And George Harrison, which is, I think, is really one of the great, almost magnificent acts of the century, said he was quite happy to put up £1 million for no other reason, apparently, that he wanted to see the movie.
Yeah. It's true, yeah.
Weren't you all in some danger of splitting up, or at least some internal conflict? Did the film, in fact, bring you together?
Yes, I mean, I think it did. After The Grail, there was about a year spent sort of in the wilderness, as it were. No one quite sure what they wanted to do. People going off to try and do their own things, Fawlty Towers or Ripping Yarns or whatever.
Also, there was a stage when we hated each other.
Well, I never hated you, John. No, whatever any of the others may say, I always liked you.
What about your solo projects? I mean, are there going to be any more Ripping Yarns, any more Fawlty Towers?
There'll be no more Fawlty Towers.
He sent me a wonderful telegram last week when I had my 40th birthday, and it read, "We love the first 40, stop. Are you going to do any more?"
You got it right.
Well, are you? I mean, is there going to be a...
I don't think so, no. I feel we've done that, just as I felt about Python and the telly, that you actually reach a point and then it's the law of diminishing returns. You could go on.
And does that mean there won't be any more Pythons on the telly?
Highly unlikely at the moment.
But not
highly
totally
well,
ruled
not totally.
Out.
I mean, I don't think anything is absolutely, definitely ruled out.
I tell you what I hate, and that's the sausage machine. And you get into it. The moment you sign on the dotted line, 13 shows, that's 8 months in the diary, filming, editing, rehearsing. It's much nicer to take 1 2-hour or hour and a half thing, like a film, and spend a lot of time, and then you can savour it and explore and do a lot of talking, which is much better than having to get everything written every day.
See, Johns gets very oppressed by work, so he doesn't like work. And I mean, what I feel about the Python shows is that actually I don't know where we would start off. I think we almost did everything in those three series, and I just don't know how
I mean,
one would begin
again. We're
practically
doing it tonight, because we were saying in the dressing room, you know, I mean, it's terribly funny. It suddenly struck us that here we are, you know, in a Bishop and Malcolm Muggeridge are going to come on, you know.
In the studio tonight.
Yes.
You know, it's not a sketch.
Yeah. It may be, John.
Are you implying that possibly there might be a third or fourth Python movie, a full-length film? This is certainly on the cards.
Yes, so. In fact, we're supposed to be meeting, aren't we? November the 19th?
Monday week,
your place?
Yeah.
to discuss this very thing. I think it's very likely that we'll do another film.
But we want to see if there's an area that nobody's gone into, really. You see, because the one thing about this film, I mean, I really like it, and there's a lot of stuff we've done I don't like that much. But I really like this film. And there are moments when I watch it, and I think... I haven't seen anything like this before on the screen.
Is there anything that you think could offend you on screen?
I have one tiny quibble, and I think that Terry Jones and Graham Chapp will no doubt disagree with me, but I think that the crucifixion thing at the end is not about pain. It's about death, and they are very separate.
So what's your beef?
My beef is that there are one or two close-ups of one or two people registering pain. And I think that confuses what the last thing's about. Because, I mean, one's not really making fun of the fact that someone has been flayed to this flesh hung down and then nailed up. The point of that last thing is it's about death. You know, it's about attitudes to death. And it's quite possible to be relatively cheery about death. Quite possible. Not so it's easy.
Yes. Well, For the moment, gentlemen, thank you very much. But I think we ought to see another clip from the movie. No, please. Stay where you are. We're going to see a second clip from the film, and after that we'll be joined by two gentlemen who don't normally review movies, but who this evening went to see it on our behalf. And our guests... And our guest reviewers are Marco Muggeridge and Mervyn Stockwood, the Bishop of Southwark. I'd like to ask you, Bishop, first, what was your review of the film?
Well, first of all, I was very glad to think that you simply can't get rid of Jesus in Europe today. Ceausescu of Romania, who I think thought, like most communists, that they're going to get rid of religion very quickly, find that, it's, as he said, it's going to hang around with us for quite a long time. And certainly, when you think of what one of the greatest attractions on the stage, both films and, I mean, acting, ever since Jesus Christ Superstar, that's what's drawn the crowds. I mean, Jesus is a most disturbing influence. You simply can't get away from him. You may worship him, respect him, commit your life to him, or just ridicule him and lampoon him, but you simply can't get rid of him. And this is what I think is a very, very interesting factor. Even in China, in their changeover now, Chairman Mao's thoughts had replaced the thoughts of Jesus, but poor old Mao and the Gang of Four now really on the dog heap, and Jesus is being allowed back. So that, first of all, is something which I find extremely interesting. Now, the second thing here's a question I would ask. What are you really trying to say in this film? I believe you were on this a wee bit earlier, but unfortunately we only got the picture outside, not the voice, which was something that husbands might want for their wives. But so we didn't quite hear your defense of it. But what I'd want to, what are you really trying to say? Now, I wasn't the least bit horrified. People say, well, no, Bishop, when you go there, you'll be absolutely horrified. I wasn't at all. After all, I wasn't vicar of the University Church for nothing. I'm familiar with undergraduate humor. And I was also a governor of a mentally deficient school. And once I was a prep school master, and I felt frightfully at home. I thought I was just sort of back on the old familiar ground this evening. But I really wondered, I mean, what you were trying to say. I do hope you don't think I'm being unkind, because I know some of you, and I'm very fond of you and have respect for you. But I say this, quite frankly, I simply don't think it was worthy of you. It was the sort of thing, as I say, that at Cambridge the footlights did on a damp Tuesday afternoon, or the lower fourth when I was a schoolmaster. I just don't know what you were saying. Then the third thing, unless I get rather more serious, I mean, why lampoon death? I think this is the thing that really is, sort of worried me. I don't think one would make a farce about Auschwitz or of death. And I mean, whatever we think about Jesus, we may think he was the Son of God, we may think he was a mistaken fanatic, but it was a pretty shattering thing what happened, the crucifixion. And you know, as I looked at that, and I thought of now, the way people react to the cross, and after all, I'm not ashamed to wear the cross here, which is the sign of a bishop. When I look at that figure, I mean, I know you're going to say Brown isn't Jesus, but I mean, that's just rubbish. The whole thing is quite clearly, if no Jesus had lived, that film wouldn't have been produced.
But did you feel that the film actually ridiculed Jesus?
Yes. I did.
Even though it wasn't about him and...
Well, I'm afraid, you see, I can't take it wasn't about him. I mean, I put that as a matter of honesty. If Jesus of Nazareth had never existed, there'd never been a Jesus, then this film of Brown would never have been produced. I'm sure that's his... if I might just say, and then do come and cross-examine me then, but my
mind is still sort of working on that last scene, sort of the reaction. I mean, there it seemed sort of a tremendous sort of joke and people were laughing. And then you think of the reaction of a person like Mother Teresa to that scene, what it meant for her. Now, she's saying, I'm not. But every day of the week I either say Mass or I'm present at Mass. I was this morning in the early hours and I broke the bread. This is my body. And I took the cup. This is my blood. And I didn't roar around with laughter at the altar in my chapel this morning. I just fell down, genuflected, and worshipped, said my Lord and my God. Now, I don't think really that... you come and get at me now.
Well,
I'm not criticising any of you personally.
Well, I hasten to say that I had absolutely nothing to do with the film whatsoever. But before I ask John and Michael to perhaps answer one of these points, could I bring in Malcolm and ask you what your review, if review is the right word?
Certainly, yes. Remember that I was engaged for 4 years in the appalling task of trying to make English people laugh as editor of Punch. It's an almost impossible thing to do. But I couldn't help feeling enormous envy of the ease with which this particular film aroused laughter. You simply had to use a four-letter word or display a man's private parts in the window, and the whole place fell on the ground with laughter. So that I, you know, professionally felt rather put out by that. Also, of course, I agree entirely with the Bishop that it is quite humbug to say that this is not a ridiculing of the founder of the Christian religion and of the Incarnation in an extremely cheap and tenth-rate way. Remember that that story of the Incarnation was what our whole civilization began with. Remember that it has inspired every great artist, every great writer, every great composer, every great builder, every great architect, that to celebrate that marvelous thing.
Germany, the Inquisition and so forth, it's sort of...
Yes, the Inquisition is there. But nothing can alter the fact that if you were to make a list of all the greatest works of art in all fields and all the greatest contributors to those works of art, you would find that this scene of the Incarnation, the story of the Incarnation, has played the largest part. Now, in our 20th century, this film produces a sort of graffiti version of it. And I don't think, in the eyes of posterity, it will have a very distinguished place. The Bishop mentioned Mother Teresa, and I was thinking of her too, because to her, you see, and it's something that the makers of this program maybe didn't even think of, but the person of Jesus Christ, not as a historical figure, not as someone in the past, but someone living in the world now, has been the essence of her existence. I once asked her what was the difference between what she did and what social workers do. And she said, well, the point is that social workers, very estimable people, but they do something, they serve their fellows for an idea. I serve my fellows for a person. And if that person wasn't there, or if that person was in some way discredited, then my work is over. And there are many people in the world, despite the fact that the media would suggest the contrary, to whom still this living presence of Jesus Christ in the world is the most essential part of their existence. And you produce it in a film as a derisory, an absurd figure. And of course, to someone who has that feeling, as Mother Teresa has, or someone like Catherine Bramwell Booth has, they are deeply hurt and insulted. That doesn't in itself matter. I'd like to put another point to you, too, that occurred to me when
is
I was
possible,
watching it.
Which Malcolm, is Awfully sorry to interrupt, but is it possible for John perhaps to answer one or two of those
points?
Otherwise we're going to have 9 points unanswered.
But yes, it's building up the list a bit. But I mean, the problem that we... No, seriously, the problem that we have got is that you think that we're ridiculing Jesus. Mm. And we say, sort of sincerely and truthfully, that is certainly not what we intended to do, and I believe that we're not. And I can best answer that, I think, by answering... his question, which is that what were we trying to do? And I think it comes out, it was spelled out perhaps rather too plainly, rather too banally at one point, when he says, make up your own mind, don't let other people tell you. And we would absolutely deny, at least I would, that there was any attempt to say you should not believe in Christ. What we're saying is take a critical view, find out about it. Don't just believe because somebody tells you to. Somebody in the pulpit says something, question it, work it out yourself.
You're seriously suggesting that if someone saw that film, say a young kid who knew nothing about the Gospels or about history, that the figure of Christ that would emerge from it, this story of the Incarnation, would be a noble one, would be...
He would have to sort it out for himself.
And you feel...
he would have to, for example, work out, I mean, does one accept every word in the Bible? In the Sermon on the Mount, did they get it all right when Mark wrote it down 30 years later? I mean, was every word right?
But is the film likely to be seen by anybody who doesn't know an awful lot about Jesus Christ?
Most certainly it is today. If you have it for children of 14 today, you will find that the many, many children of 14 today, thanks to the secular nature of the education they're receiving, know nothing about it at all. And they would see this figure in the light in which he appears in this film, you see. It's no good you cheating yourselves. Yeah. You can't have it both ways. You produce this particular... film which arouses bursts of laughter, as I said earlier, rather easily procured. But don't imagine that someone seeing that is going to go away with the concept of the founder of the Christian religion and all that that meant to mankind in any way corresponding to what history or the Gospels or anything else that's presented.
Well, Michael, it's not supposed to be about him, so people shouldn't go
and
see it to
learn saying that. It's not about him.
Michael, you're being dishonest. I mean,
you're being utterly dishonest,
can I just
my dear.
I don't know where this will get us, but I feel my approach to the film was I was confused. I feel I'm still asking questions, seeking solutions. I am very confused and perturbed by a religion, an established religion in this country, where people can go into church on a Sunday morning, the same people can sing hymns and say prayers, and at the same time these people can stand by while their money is spent making bombs, making guns, building up appalling weapons of destruction, can sit by, sing hymns, say their prayers, and agree with a policy in which hospitals have to go without money.
First of all, I'd very much like to know where we'll get your evidence. You must give me chapter and verse. So happens that immediately before coming here, I was asked by crowds of church people if I would stand up for the councils over the health of St. Olive's Hospital, which the government is trying to close. The church is extremely active in these fields, and I would urge you not to make these careless generalizations are not dependent on evidence.
Now, I make them in all humility. I'm seeking answers and solutions. I'm not saying this is absolutely the way it is, but I have observed
what you were saying, for me, it's a great religion, sheer rubbish. And you made a ridiculous generalization which is unworthy of an educated man. Now, having said this, back to what you say, somebody aged 14 coming and seeing this thing of Jesus, what you are seeing is not one of the greatest teachers in the world. I mean, granted, lots of people, majority of people, wouldn't accept him as the Son of God as I do, but surely most of us would see him as one of the greatest teachers of the world. Now, you wouldn't guy Socrates or make him appear as a clown. And what I think
maybe
this
maybe there are funny things about it.
What?
Maybe there are funny things about Socrates. Why shouldn't we make jokes about
well,
Socrates?
Well, if there are certain aspects of the world, you would not Socrates.
No,
It's not my point.
Socrates,
I don't know enough
also
about Socrates.
Was murdered. He was made to drink poison. You wouldn't guy him at that point or make him appear as a clown. And what I say, and I'm afraid you won't alter my conviction, John, over this, is that this most, what is to a Christian, the most sacred moment of the whole Jesus experience, namely his death, that at that most sacred moment, he was guyed and made to look as a clown.
May I make another point here, which is rather interesting, that if you'd made that film about, if you'd made that film about Muhammad, you see, there would have been an absolute hullabaloo in this country, because all the sort of the racial, anti-racialist people would have risen up in their might. The same people who would approve of this and would have said this is quite disgraceful. And behind people's minds would be the thought maybe they might lose a bit of oil, by doing it. But you see the difference.
You're right, Malcolm. I mean, 400 years ago, we would have been burnt for this film. Now, I'm suggesting that we've made an advance.
Well, I'm suggesting... I'm suggesting that compared with other presentations of this great event, the incarnation, you have not made an advance, and that anybody in the future who might dredge up this miserable little film, and it's quite possible they might as a piece of social history, they would certainly not wish to relate it to the thing, say, Chartres Cathedral, which is built to the glory of, Christ.
Not a funny building, actually.
But they might want to compare it with Fawlty Towers.
Yes, they're not even intended to be a funny building.
Well, it has the gargoyles on it,
Michael.
I think that, and I've seen this in the sort of reviews of the film, they concentrate always on the religious angle. Even, before they've seen it, they've decided this is a film about religion. I don't think it is entirely. I think that what we've chosen to do is what we've always done in Python. We've done for three series, we've done for three films. We have taken a certain group of people, which are generally sort of England in the present day, and put them into a historical context. I think that's what we've done with this film. I think it isn't entirely about religion. It's about the people who live in... anyone who lives and makes up our society today.
It's also about closed systems of thought, whether they're political or theological or religious, whatever. Systems by which whatever evidence is given to the person, he merely adapts it, fits it into his ideology. You show the same event to a Marxist and a Catholic, for example, they both of them fine, they both have explanations of it. I mean, it's what to be pompous poppers on about with falsifiability of theories. I mean, once you've actually got an idea that is whirring round so fast that no other light or contrary evidence can come in, then I think it's very dangerous. I don't think it's dangerous to someone like Malcolm, because he's actually a very nice man. But I think he is the sort of guy that this film is actually having a go at, because I don't think that there's any evidence that can come to him now that is going to make him rethink, think, am I right? Am I making a mistake?
Well, you can leave that out. I think I could say with utter sincerity that there was nothing in this particular film that would lead me to want to change conclusions that I've reached after living for 76 years in this world.
Is there anything? That's the point I'm making.
Well, in this film there was nothing that could possibly, because the film itself bore so little...
No, but the point I was making, Mark, was not the film. Forget the film. We'll say that's rubbish. Okay. Is there anything that can happen to you now that could cause you to change your mind?
But of course, every single person who is alive and spiritually alive is constantly reviewing his faith. I do not believe for a moment that there is a definitive faith, and you say, there it is. But there's nothing in this little squalid number that could possibly affect anybody. Now, in that sense, I give you
might
this point.
Not,
I give you this point that there's nothing in this film that could possibly destroy anybody's genuine faith.
No, I grant you absolutely not,
because it's much too tenth rate for that. But but what I still contend is that someone who is young, 14 years old, seeing that without any particular background, might really imagine that that buffoonery is an expression of this great episode.
Well,
which...
you see, I was also, you talked about the presentation of Christianity. I mean, I went to an English preparatory school and an English public school, Clifton College, or the Sports Academy.
I sympathise with you.
I was given 10 years of a form of Christianity which I grew to despise and dislike. Largely, it insulted my intelligence. The sermons that were given at the age of 11 and 12, I felt, insulted my intelligence. When I got into writing this film, and we all had exactly the same reaction, we started to discover a lot of stuff about Christianity, and I started to get angry. Because I started to think, why was I given this rubbish, this tenth-rate series of platitudes, when there were interesting things to have discussed? There were factual
and
things. Nobody ever told me that they don't know what language the Gospels were written in, that they don't even know who wrote them, and they're not even sure what cities they were
written
in.
Well, then you must have read very superficially at your school.
Look, John, it's very bad luck for you, but you see, I used to go to Clifton College to preach very often when you were there.
I know the headmaster, I know the staff, I know the students.
All I can say is you must have been as idle a boy, as splendid an actor as you are.
Because if you really take this seriously,
I mean, you had some absolute first-class teachers.
Those services were a joke. They were a joke.
Well, and because you made them. I know people from Clifton College of exactly your own period.
I remember
who are now
the
priests
sermons.
In my diocese.
I remember the sermons. I remember.
You don't remember mine. Tell me what I preached on.
No idea. I only remember the bad ones.
Well,
I remember a gentleman coming and telling us how very difficult it had proved to get the Bible into Tibet, you know? They'd had seven occasions. The first time there'd been landslides, the second time there'd been rains, and the pages had got stuck together. The third time, no, this is true, the third time the mules had fallen off the mountainside, the fourth time there were thunderbolts, and the seventh time he said, God helped us, and we got the Bibles into Tibet. And the obvious conclusion was that he was trying like hell to stop them getting the Bible.
But you really are lampooning this, because by O-levels and A-levels, going on the whole time, people were taking the scripts. They'd had to have studied Greek, perhaps Hebrew, and have had made a serious study of the scriptures. You chose not to do that. I'm sure
we
you
made
had
a
far more interesting
study.
Things to do.
We only had 4 years to write the film. We didn't want to get too specialist, because if we got
I'm sorry, I'm talking about Clifton College. But I don't really think this has got very much to do with
it. Could I just ask, as... I think, in theory, anyway, a sort of moderator. I'm supposed to be neutral.
Or the Church of Scotland or the Church of England.
I'm supposed to be in the middle, but didn't you... I mean, I felt when I saw the film, and I saw it in a cinema in New York with a very appreciative audience, did you not feel that, in fact, the people being lampooned were the followers rather than Jesus himself?
I thought that very strongly. No, I don't think so. It was... I really felt, I mean, the crucifixions above all else, which are things I felt sad about, because, I mean, I'm quite sure, as all of us will one day, and this is not trying to attack your vulnerabilities, but life is very short, all of us will be on our deathbeds in a comparatively short time, and when we are, and that'll be no laughing matter, that it is much that Christ, which I should like to be held up in front of me, than the Christ I saw
but the
on
film
the cross
did,
this afternoon.
Did bring home to me. Sorry. Yeah. I was going to say very quickly that the film reminded me of something which I obviously knew, but one tends to forget, that it wasn't only Jesus that was crucified. I mean, an awful lot of people were crucified in the most horrific circumstances every day of the week under Roman rule.
Yes, that's very true.
And that fact came home in the film. You realise that Jesus didn't have a sort of total... copyright crucifixion.
No, but Jesus was crucified, wasn't he, for his obedience to the will of God.
He was crucified, surely, for blasphemy.
They accused him of blasphemy because he was obedient to the will of God and of his kingdom. You can't say that came over
today that with any of the people who were being crucified.
No, but that wasn't
true. I mean, the whole way that it was done, they were not dying for a noble idea.
Well, neither were the...
Yeah, but I mean, I think that what... Can I just make the point I was trying to make earlier on about the film not being seen entirely in religious terms? That, I mean, as Tim has said, people were crucified then as common criminals. It was just a form of capital punishment employed by the Romans, who were regarded as a highly civilized people. But it was capital punishment. And in the film, we examine attitudes to capital punishment. As far as I know, in this country, the majority of people we are constantly told are in favor of capital punishment. It just seems that we haven't come that far in all that time.
Why do you think that through all these centuries of Christendom that the greatest minds, the most creative minds, the greatest artists were believers in this thing that you airily dismiss and say that you, making this little film, have managed to see deeply into it
and
reach conclusions?
I can't say they are. What about Bertrand Russell?
I said in the centuries of Christendom. I didn't say in our time. I said that if you were to make a list of all the people who have contributed most
of them would have been Muslims if they'd been living in the Arab countries, or Buddhists if they'd been living.
What has that got to do with it? These people were inspired by this event, which you have celebrated in this film by a lot of people on crosses singing a sort of rather inferior musical.
Death perhaps doesn't matter that much, after all you're saying the whole time. You're looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it keenly. But I'm looking forward to it.
About it?
No, I'm looking forward to it keenly because I relate it to these very things that you dismiss. I relate it to the story of the Incarnation, this great drama of the Incarnation, which you have reduced to a sort of comic film. Now, you think that in doing that, you have shed light. But I have to tell you that you haven't shed light. You've made some rather bad jokes, and the only reason that people come to see it is because they still relate it to this extraordinary story of the Incarnation, which is, in fact, the beginning and the end of everything that our civilization stands for. Our civilization began with a man, the Apostle Paul, telling pagan world about the Incarnation. That was the beginning
but
of it.
We're not the only civilization in the world.
Not at all.
No,
I'm not saying
a lot
we are.
Of civilizations
certainly.
With different religions,
certainly.
Right?
I'm not.
And the important thing is that people should be open to the various possibilities and that they should take a critical attitude to
them. But whoever said they shouldn't be open? But you don't make people open by producing the sort of buffoonery that
you
produce.
You certainly don't
there.
Make people open by giving them the kind of garbage I was given at school.
Well, then I'm very sympathetic to you for having received this garbage, some of it at the hands of our friend Bishop here. I'm very sympathetic indeed, and I think it's very sad and tragic that you should have been cut off from something that's so wonderful and only given garbage. But I would simply point out to you that if you care about what constitutes what we call Western civilization, which now probably is coming to an end, and you were to consider the role that's been played in that by this thing that you treat as a piece of buffoonery, you would have a certain humility in saying that you have been able, through making it, to shed light.
But you keep
something.
Making the basic assumption. Sorry, let me just say this, Mike. You keep making the basic assumption that we are ridiculing Christ and Christ's teaching, and I say that we are not.
But do you imagine that your scene, for instance, of the Sermon on the Mount, the scene in your film of the Sermon on the Mount, is not ridiculing one of the most sublime utterances that any human being has ever spoken on this earth? Of course it is.
No, it's
absolutely
making fun
not.
Of the guy who's remembered it wrong and of the people who don't understand it and miss the point.
Well, I think
that's really unfair because I think that a lot of people looking in will think that we have actually ridiculed Christ physically. Christ is played by an actor, Ken Colley. He speaks the words from the Sermon on the Mount. He's treated absolutely respectfully. The camera then pans away. We go to right to the back of the crowd to someone who shouts, "Speak up," because they cannot hear him. Now, I mean, if that utterly undermines
that
one's faith in Christ,
no,
then I think your faith can be quite strong.
Say, I started off by saying that this is such a 10th-rate film that I don't believe that it would disturb anybody's faith.
Yes, I know you started with an open mind. I realise that.
I certainly...
John, can I put you a question? Now, without, I hope, in any way sort of being pompous, I mean, I have been Bishop of South London now for over 20 years, and I'm appalled by the sadness, the unhappiness, the tragedy of life, and the drug scene, the violence, the muggings, and so on. And many people now are standing back with a measure of deep disturbance and horror. I was at the University at Cambridge only the Sunday before last, and I'm told how the undergraduates are now turning up in chapel and seeing if Christianity has got something to offer. Most of us, I'm sure we'd be all, however much we may differ on this film, that we are deeply disturbed by what's going on in the world and in this country. Now, there is a desire to find truth, to find some answer to our problems. And the question, I would put to you, could you really put your hand on your heart and say that film is going to help the younger generation
absolutely.
And its pilgrimage for truth?
If they think
about it,
absolutely. The message is, what is it, Mike? What are the words? Work it out for yourself. You're all individuals. Don't do what people tell you to do. And that's not the
you find that a final as a final
no starting point.
Starting point.
Including the lampooning of Christ.
And what? The lampooning of his death, which is the most disgraceful part of the whole thing.
Well, I think that's just
thing.
Surely, Malcolm, it was the lampooning of a form of death, which happened to
you're
hundreds of
people. You're lampooning a scene which has been played a fantastic part in the lives of believers for generations, a scene that has inspired the most amazing disinterestedness, creativity, that set St. Francis of Assisi wandering about the streets, that inspired St. Augustine to write The City of God.
I accept, but
all
I think
that is true, and all you've done is to make a lot of people on a cross singing a music hall song. It's so disgusting when you think of it.
A lot of people go away very happy, laughing at that. Their faith not touched one jot.
I don't think
it'll really
touch
do.
Faith. I don't think it will.
Come back at this point. Yes. And a lot of people on the first Good Friday went away from Calvary laughing their heads off and thinking the death of Jesus was a tremendous joke.
Well, that's very true, you know, because, as a matter of fact, all you've done is to, for the person you followed in this film is Herod, because it was Herod who organized this absurd scene, and I'm only amazed that you didn't get some comic effects out of the crown of thorns. That's the only thing that puzzles me in the film.
If you wanted to make a joke out of Jesus, Jesus would have appeared on the cross. He was an actor. He was there in the film. Mm. He does not appear on the cross. Nowhere at all. It's a gang of thieves, of common criminals, who were at that time crucified in hundreds day by day. I mean, that's... I'm sorry, I know that you think I'm wrong, but that's what I feel.
I
it is not Christ.
I think it's a ludicrous thing, can because I tell you that the people see...
This is what the film's about.
Malcolm, can I just say that to an outsider, the crucifixion is a much stronger event if one realises that Christ went through something that everybody went through. If you treat it like something that only he went through, which is the image you get. I never realised I was about 16 everybody got crucified.
He was crucified between...
I also have to say that we have to...
He was crucified between two thieves. If you're saying that the experience of those three people was the same experience simply because they went through the same physical experience, then you are utterly misunderstanding what the crucifixion means, what the passion means, why it's had this enormous role in people's lives. It wouldn't have had that role if it was simply one of innumerable men dying on a cross. It's because of what it signified that in terms of the incarnation. And of course, you leave that all out of account. What you've done is you've succeeded in doing, and that for that reason it will have absolutely no influence in the long run, you have succeeded in reducing something which has inspired the greatest art into something which is presented in terms of the lowest art. That's your feat. That's your
set up your own terms that we have to influence people. We're not saying we want to influence people. We're trying to make them laugh, make them happy. I mean, it's that's something that helps.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to call a halt. I'm very sorry. I think you've made people happy and made them think and made them laugh. And
I think we'll make them talk about it.
I can't.
Well, you'll get your 30 pieces. You'll get your 30 pieces of silver. I'm quite sure.
I hasten to add that.
If you're missing the most wonderful thing in life, and you're seeing it in those terms, and it's utterly tragic.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Utterly tragic.
I hope that film won't shake anybody's faith.